So I realized that if I'm able to identify these pain points, develop lean products in a very short period of time, and sell them quickly in a very affordable price, this is very interesting. And do it as a one-man show so I can be very, very affordable. So then I started like developing more and more products. Now, these days I have 15 products that are running. Most of these products don't even have a UI.
Welcome to the Nomad Podcast, where we discuss inspiring stories of lifestyle transition and how to thrive in a location-independent existence. Nomad Podcast is supported in part by Nomad Prep, an online academy to help aspiring digital nomads make a successful transition. And now here's your host, Sean Tierney.
A common mistake amongst entrepreneurs is becoming obsessed with your product idea and winding up building something that nobody wants nor needs. Yanir Kalisar is no stranger to this and has managed to learn the technical and business skills via his involvement with numerous startups throughout his career that have allowed him to build a portfolio of micro-niche products that now sustain him while he works on his moonshot product, Whatsly. In this interview on my last day in Koh Tao, Thailand, we talk about Yanir's process for rapidly validating a product idea and hammering out a proof of concept in 48 hours, his philosophy on lean product development, the startup scene in Tel Aviv, Israel, stories of advanced open water night diving, delicious hummus, and more. But before we dig into the interview, please enjoy a quick word from our sponsor. It's important to have travel insurance as a nomad because stuff happens while we're on the road. And while we hope for the best, we need to always plan for the worst. If you're investigating insurance options, check out Safety Wing. Safety Wing is travel medical insurance specifically designed for nomads. Unlike other providers, you can buy it when you're already on the road and you don't need to continuously update them on when and where you're going next. You just have one monthly subscription that covers you wherever you go for both travel and medical. And if you shop around, you'll find it's about a third of the price of other providers. Visit nomadpodcast.com/safetywing to get a quote today. And now here's the interview. All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Sean Tierney, and I am here today with Yanir Kalisar. Yanir is an entrepreneur and experienced marketing technologist with a track record of success. He's worked at four different companies that went through acquisitions. Incitera acquired by Marketo, then Marketo acquired by Vista Ventures, which is then reacquired by Adobe. He also worked at Aptrinsic, later acquired by Gainsight. Yanir is founder of a company called Overstack.io, which has run for the last 3 years, and as of a year ago, also a new company called Whatsly. Yanir is skilled in marketing automation and CRM, account-based marketing, analytics, and the customer journey, has an MBA in big data and AI, and focuses primarily on marketing and product management. Welcome, Yanir.
Yeah, hi, Sean. great to be here in Koh Tao with you today. Great day over here.
It is a great day, man. I'll let you kind of paint the picture of where we're at. I mean, so this is, how would you describe this paradise?
I think, yeah, paradise, this is the right word. I think it's great being here. The weather is awesome. I just finished my first time diving course. It was very interesting, and there are great sights over here in Koh Tao.
Yeah, you just did a night dive last night?
Yeah, last night. Yeah, it was a bit scary at the beginning, but we survived. We survived to tell the story. But definitely, Koh Tao is one of the awesomest places I've been to.
I 100% agree with you. I just got my advanced as well 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I think there's probably no better place to knock it out. It's definitely cheaper than other spots I've been to.
For sure. And Thailand in general is awesome. I love my time over here. Yeah. My second time, so I guess the third time would be even better. So it's getting better and better.
Cool. Well, just some context for our listeners on how we met. So we both work at a workspace down the hill here, and I think just one day I overheard you on the phone. It sounded like a product pitch, and the stuff you were talking about, I said, I got to talk to this guy. He's doing all the same stuff that I'm involved with.
Yeah, it was actually a conference meeting. Like there were 100 people on the other side of the video conferencing, and I was pitching my new solution, Whatsly. It was an accelerator sponsored by very big companies in Europe, and they just asked me to attend like physically, but then I told them, oh, I can't because I'm currently not in Israel. The funny thing is that they didn't ask me where I'm at, so I survived that because if I would tell them where I'm at, it was a bit difficult to explain. But yeah, for sure, Tau Ab, great place. Highly recommended to visit here if you're digital nomads and traveling around.
Yeah. Cool. And also, just preface and heads up here, if you hear some background noise, we've got motorcycles that are going by. It's just, it is what it is. It's Thailand. So we'll do our best. So what is Whatsley? Can you just describe what that product is?
Yeah, sure. So Whatsley, I think this is the most interesting product I've been working on for the past 10 years. Basically, a year ago, I identified the problem that today's companies are communicating like they do above and behind to make customers happy from the service that they're getting, and to improve customer experience, of course. And then customers today want to use WhatsApp for all communication that they're having with anyone. On the other hand, customers are unable to communicate with customers over WhatsApp because it's a closed messaging app. Like, you cannot integrate it with almost anything. So then I realized that there is a way to integrate it with Salesforce, with the CRM of Salesforce. And this is basically the most popular CRM in the world. So once I cracked this this way, then I started developing the product. It took me 48 hours to get to the first POC of the product. And within 5 days, I got my first customer for that. So basically, it enables customer-facing agents in the companies to talk with customers the same way they're already doing today over WhatsApp, but then just sync and copy the chat that they are having into Salesforce automatically. Nice. And also, while they're chatting with the customers, see all the known information about the customer. For example, job title, email, address, whatever they want, whatever known information they have about this customer.
Nice. And so this allows someone to not even change their habits of how they communicate, just to continue using WhatsApp.
Exactly.
And they get all the benefits of basically using like one of these chat clients with
exactly.
their customers.
Exactly. And from the customer perspective, it's amazing because the experience is much better. They get better service because their agents know them better and they're using the messaging app that they want, that they like most. From the company's perspective, it's a game changer because now managers, like sales managers, customer service managers, are able to gain visibility of these interactions that until today, they didn't know what's going on there. Yeah. And in the future, we're planning to expand our capabilities and also provide sentiment analysis and more deeper analytics about these interactions.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is what, when I overheard your conversation, this is what grabbed me, is because in my role at Pagely, I've been involved in exploring alternate mediums of communication. And you know, we've gone through a number of chatbots between Olark and Drift and Intercom and some of these systems that you use to chat with your people on your website. But in addition to that, also, you know, getting out of the email inbox. So what can we, you know, if email starts failing and they're not responding to it, can we get them through LinkedIn? Can we get them through Twitter or Quora or however, what other handles we have to be able to go and approach that and message that person? So this is fascinating to me that you're able to marry this and make it a seamless experience for for the customer.
And actually, you mentioned chatbots. And chatbots, like Whatsley, doesn't replace chatbots because if, for example, you are a bank, and most of your customers are just contacting you in like by phone or by your chat, your web chat or something. So in most cases, they will ask common questions like your business hours, your nearest location and stuff like that. And this is great use case for using chatbots, right? Just giving the same answer. But let's say my insurance agent or like the telecom company I'm working on for my business, I expect my personal agent to give me the answers that I need. And in this case, even without Whatsley, I'm talking to my agent directly over WhatsApp. We are not replacing this part. It will continue the same as it used to be. But now we're just enabling companies to do it in a much smarter way.
Well, and imagine another benefit, because you could just connect your agent directly with the person, and then now you're having like all these one-off WhatsApp conversations, but then it's not routing through the company. So then A, they don't have like transparency and analytics and, like you said, sentiment analysis and all these benefits you get by routing it through the company.
Exactly.
So I imagine that's going to be like a really important thing.
Yeah. And actually, we're seeing great success so far. We're already working with a few dozens of companies around the world in 17 countries. And we're expecting to grow very, very fast. We're now, we recently became approved Salesforce AppExchange partners. So soon we'll be in their app store. Great things are going on these days.
I know. I think you were doing the contract for that when I was doing a contract for a very large one of our clients as well. And we're both kind of commiserating on these 50-page contracts. can you talk about, because I think one of the most fascinating things from our conversation thus far before this was how you rapidly prototype. You know, you come up with the POC, the proof of concept, in 48 hours, setting yourself very hardcore time constraints to be able to do that in the businesses. And you've made many businesses a lot of these little micro niche products. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about your approach there and how you do that?
You call it, I like the name you gave it, micro niche. So let me just go back a little bit in time. You mentioned the companies I worked for. And I had, when I started my career 11 years ago, I just had like some background, some technical background. I used to build websites when I was in high school. When I joined Insightera, I was the first employee over there. I joined the two co-founders, Mickey Alon and Mike Tellem. And they told me, okay, we're doing marketing technology. We're developing a web personalization platform for B2B companies. It sounded like unclear to me. I didn't know what it means. But then Mike Tellem told me, don't worry, I will teach you everything you need to know. You do sales marketing, I'll onboard you to this space. And I think that the opportunity of working in a small startup from day one to the point where it got acquired, I think it's a great experience. And then it helped me to identify challenges and pain points that companies are having and understand the process of how to combine it, how to add it into the product. So many times it happened that I went to the engineering team and told them, look, this customer, and this is a very important customer, he wants the product to do also this thing. And then like seeing how they're brainstorming about how to do something like that, how they're developing it and how they're deploying it, and then go back to the customer and explaining how we solved his pain point. It was very, very interesting to see. And it taught me how to think that way. So I don't think you must work for a startup, but this is like even a part-time work in a small startup, early stage startup, gives you this kind of experience. Afterwards, when we joined Marketo in 2014, it was I suddenly saw that the same processes that happened at Insightera also happened in big companies. Like we were 1,500 people back then in Marketo, and it also had the same processes, but this time it took longer. And then I realized that even that there is some opportunity over here, because big companies, when they get great ideas from customers, it might take them sometimes 6 months, sometimes a year and a half, and sometimes it will never happen until they will get to a new feature or a new product or a new part of existing product. So I realized there is a huge opportunity here, because if you build like a small company that just develops these small features, these micro products, I think this is a game changer.
Yeah.
And this is how I what led me to think like in a creative way of, okay, let's identify more and more and more pain points that companies are trying to are facing with, and let's build these micro products and let's do it quickly.
Yeah,
because then, like, even a bit larger company than your company cannot compete with you.
So you happen to be in these companies, so you're basically in the firefight and, like, you know, getting bombarded with a lot of feedback, and you had a lot of ideas that were coming at you. I guess what I am curious about is, how do you sleuth out what those problems are? You know, it seems like typically what happens is someone gets an idea in their head and they go and build it, and they haven't validated demand, and they haven't proven that a lot of people want this, and they're very motivated to pay for it. Do you have any advice for people in that situation, like, that are not in a role where they're exposed to all these challenges and they can kind of start to make patterns out of it?
Yeah, so I have three parts for the answer. So first part, and this is something that I've been doing for the past 15 years, I always try to open myself to many spaces. So for example, CRM and sales operation solutions, and then marketing, so analytics and content and automation platforms and BI worlds, like spaces, like tools like Integromat and Zapier. And then also I added the technological part. So learn how to develop Java and JavaScript and Python and CSS, everything I could, and Node.js. And then slowly I started going more to the data part. So because I realized that CRM and marketing and automation and database, and so I started learning some data modeling. For example, I tried to play with sentiment analysis. I tried to play with video analysis, and I just played around. Every time I had like crazy idea, I told myself, let's just play around with it like for a day or two. And then you get more and more experience in that. And every time I was reading a lot about new startups, I figured that most of the startups are not inventing something completely new out of the blue. They're just taking one solution from one space, for example, from customers' success, and then just converting it, transforming it into marketing, or from marketing into sales. For example, we talked about account-based marketing. So I think that account-based marketing, and I had an interesting conversation about it a week ago also, with someone that is coming from the sales world.
Can you just define that term for the people that don't know what that is? I know what it is.
So account-based marketing means that, it will be easier to say where it started. So a long time ago, and we're talking about 8 to 10 years ago, sales teams and marketing teams weren't very good friends, because marketing used to work very, very hard to generate leads that they thought would be amazing. And then every quarter or every 6 months, they would come to the salespeople, tell them, here, we got you great leads. But the sales team weren't so happy with these leads, because these are not the leads that they wanted to get. And then slowly what happened, the marketing teams got very, very angry about it. And they told them, okay, so stop everything. You gonna tell us which companies you want us to bring you. And then they said, okay, no problem. We have this list ready. Every quarter we have it ready over here. We have 100 companies that we're trying to chase after. This is the list. Now get us these leads. And then the marketing teams said, okay. They took the list and they started to look for solutions that will help them get leads from these companies. So I'm going back to Insightera. At Insightera, for example, we identified that we are very, very, the sales team identified that we are very, very successful with specifically with Marketo customers. So it was, from that moment on, it was very easy. We just got a list of Marketo customers and we started targeting them in any way we could. Emails, social media, even events. We started going to the Marketo annual events. It was very, very easy. And then suddenly we grew we grew very, very fast. Another segment, for example, that we had, account-based segment that we had, is like our competitors' customers. So we said, okay, like they have annual subscription.
How did you get the customer list of your competitors?
Any way we could. So for example, we researched on the website. We saw a list of 50 customers. We said, okay, these 50 customers, we're trying to get them. Another method, by the way, is to because the type of solution that we've developed requires JavaScript on the website. And there are tools like BuiltWit and Datanize that enables you to track to get a list of all the websites that have this kind of pixel installed. So we just got this list and we started chasing them. Sometimes it was one by one. And then we started using our own technology. So for example, if someone from company X, which is our competitor's customer, is visiting our website, we would tell them, check out our competitors' table. Like, read how we are different or how we are better than what you're using now. And even more advanced than that, because we knew exactly at what date they implemented the pixel on the website, so we estimated that there is a year until they will need to renew. So 3 months before that date, we were just contacting them directly and telling them, you are about to renew your contract. Check out our solution before you're doing it.
Nice.
It actually worked. We were actually managed to get crazy deals that way.
Yeah.
And this was back in 2012. We didn't even know that it's called account-based marketing, because account-based marketing wasn't a real name, a real thing back then.
I mean, to me, account-based marketing is just starting with the end in mind. It's like you said, figure out the list of the people that you want to go get, and rather than just sit here and throw off a bunch of things and hope that you get people coming through SEO and whatnot.
Spray and pray.
You're basically starting with the end in mind. Say, look, this is the Alexa list of the top 100 customers with these criteria, or built with, or Datanize, or whatever source you want to use. And then you're saying, how do we go hunt these people?
Yeah.
How do we go, you know, what are the types of activities that will make those folks come to us, or that will allow us to get access to them?
Yeah. And the fun thing that this approach actually works. It actually works. So today for my business, I'm doing it still manually. I'm not like I'm doing it with some hacks that I built. So for example, I know how to identify Salesforce customers, and I know how to identify if they are communicating with customers over WhatsApp. And then I have this list of thousands of companies that I'm contacting them directly.
And are you using an automated outreach to do that, or are you like one by one cold calling? How are you doing that?
Yeah, so we try doing cold calling. The thing is that in order to make it worth it, so we need to contact like the larger teams, the larger companies, and then it's a bit more difficult doing this. But we have different methods. I can tell you that because we're very lean yet, so most cases, instead of just using big and very pricey solution, I'm just, you know, writing a few lines of codes and just automating it. I'm using a lot Integromat, and I'm also their partner. And I think Integromat is a great solution. I'm just automating everything.
Let me ask you this. What do you like about Integromat better than Zapier? Because I'm a huge Zapier fan, but I'm very interested always in seeing what else is better.
First of all, I think their user interface is much more friendly. It's much easier to start with Integromat rather than Zapier. I think it's the look and feel. That's it. I tried, like, because I'm a technical person, so I tend to, so if it's a very technical product and you need to code and stuff, so okay, it's fine. But if it shouldn't be a technical product, so it needs to be super, super easy to operate. Like in a click of a button, you have everything set up. So like two sides here. And I think that Zapier falls in between. So it's a bit technical, but it should be easy to operate. So it's somewhere. It's, for example, I don't like WordPress. I am sorry to say that.
You realize Pagely is a WordPress host.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Like there are great solutions that work on WordPress, but like just working with a basic UI, I don't know. I personally don't really like it. For example, my website Overstack.io, I started building it with WordPress, but then I just realized, okay, I can do it with HTML in one day, and that's it. I just want to go back to your original question. So I think that like combining a few spaces, and then I think that just about the WordPress. So I learned in the past 3 years, because I'm running as a one-man show, and I have like teams all around the world. So I learned how to outsource my work. Whatever I can do, or I can let someone else do, I'm just doing it. Yeah. Even if it costs, if it's a bit pricey, but it's worth it, because like it will take me 2 weeks to do it, but on the other hand, I can let it to someone that will do it 2 days, and I'll do more important stuff. So WordPress, for example, I'm just outsource it, let it to someone else to do it, and I'm just fixing whatever it needs later on.
Cool. So the What's Apply product, or Whatsly is the name of it. Does Whatsly sustain you, or is this kind of the big bet and you have other kind of bread and butter stuff that sustains you? Like, how do you pay your way?
Yeah, so basically Overstack, this is the more sustainable company today, because it's more mature, obviously. Whatsly is still growing, and I'm spending most of my time on Whatsly, like 95% of my time. I'll say a few words about Overstack. So the idea of Overstack was exactly what I described earlier, because I realized that there are many small but very painful problems that companies are facing with, specifically marketing teams are facing with these days. So I realized that if I am able to identify these pain points, develop lean products in a very short period of time, and sell them quickly in a very affordable price, so this is very interesting. And do it as a one-man show, so I can be very, very affordable. So then I started like developing more and more products. Now, these days I have 15 products that are running. Most of these products don't even have a UI. So these are just processes that run on a daily or weekly basis. And I'm just selling them to companies to solve the problem. And just the process that I'm doing when I'm developing new products is, in most of the cases, customers approach to me. So I work with many partners and many great companies, great customers that I have, and they are very innovative. They have a lot. They always try new things. They always try to get better in what they do. And when you are acting like that, you will always find challenges and problems in your daily work. And I always tell them, whenever you're doing something twice, let me know. And every conversation, every call that I have with them, I'm in some point of the call, I'm asking them, okay, what doesn't work? What is broken? What needs to be fixed?
Yeah.
And then this is a great approach. And I think that the second thing that I would say, besides like getting to know many spaces, besides your specific space, is to always talk to people and get and hear what's bothering them in their daily work, because this is it's a great position to be at, the place where you're getting all the problems, and then this is a great way to validate your product, the things that you are working on, because if you just wake up and say, okay, let's develop, I don't know, something, some app for dogs, so this is nice, you thought about it, it's okay. because you have like 10 dogs. But if you see one problem that comes from a customer, and then you, the next question should be, how much are you willing to pay to solve this problem? And I'm asking that because they are friends of mine and we have a good relationship. But they sometimes they say, okay, I will pay like $1,000 per month to solve this problem. And then I'm saying, okay, this is an opportunity. This is interesting.
Can you just like mention what is an example problem? Yeah, I know, we were talking before over.
Yeah.
You know.
So I had one customer asking me like 2.5 years ago. He told me like we're trying to build data lake for the marketing organization, and then just have all the information, all the data from all our platforms in this data lake, and later on connect this data lake, this data warehouse, connected to some BI tool. In their case, it was Tableau. But the one thing that we cannot connect is Marketo. So what can you do to help us? And then I realized, okay, there is an opportunity because this is a common problem, a common challenge that probably many companies trying to solve. And then I just told them, okay, let's do a project. We'll develop it. Both of us will have the IP for this development. And we can do whatever we want. If you want to make it a product, go ahead. I will go and make it a product. And this became one of my most successful products. And then I already cloned this project for a few other companies. Because this is a really painful thing. It's a problem. You cannot connect one of your marketing stack into your data lake. Another problem that I guess most of the marketeers in the audience are aware of is attribution, marketing attribution. So we all are putting a lot of effort in tagging our links with UTM parameters and like tracking them on Google Analytics. This is great. But in B2B, where it takes like sometimes even a year for a deal to be closed, so people don't have only one touch point. They have multiple touch points. Sometimes it's hundreds of touch points. And you want to be able to track everything. So you can go and buy a solution for $100,000 per year that's like captures these UTMs. But I have a solution that does that in a much more affordable way. And you can have all the data. Like I don't have a platform and like dashboards and reports and stuff. You will just get a CSV file. Shows you all the data. And then in big companies, it's great. This is exactly what they want. They want the raw data to upload it to their very expensive BI platform. So this is a solution of mine that is called Touchpoints.
Multi-touch attribution. Yeah, I saw that on your website. Yeah, so this is a perfect example, though, where unless you have the insight from having talked to a number of people and realizing all they want is a CSV, they just want the raw data, you don't need to go build some complex UI to expose this and dashboards and whatnot, like you said, because that's not even really what they want. So that type of insight, though, only comes through having a lot of those conversations mm-hmm. and really getting to understand like what they want out of it. The other thing, like just to unpack a lot of what you said, because there's a couple interesting things in there, I think, is that a lot of times people, I think, start dreaming up an app and they can only think in terms of, well, what can I build that has an interface and yada, yada, you know, like that's their thought of like, I got to build an app. When you said there is no UI for a lot of the products that you made, it's just it's a problem that you're solving in the background.
Exactly.
Right. And it likely is a lot more painful to these companies when it's something like, you know, is important as what you're calling a data lake, what I would call a data warehouse. You know, that is like the core, you know, what drives business intelligence for a company and making sure that data is accurate. That's a hugely, you know, painful problem for them. And so I just think it's fascinating that people get seduced by the idea of what they can see when these little silent background micro products are actually probably you can charge a lot more for them. And I want to take a second to briefly pause here and tell you about an exciting project that I'm working on. I recently left my job of 5 years to go full-time on a side project that I started called Charity Makeover. This is a hackathon that brings volunteer knowledge workers together to build game-changing digital assets for local charities in a single day. Think of it like a Habitat for Humanity, only with virtual assets instead of physical houses. I recently deployed a platform that enables anyone to bring this movement to his or her city. If you think you might be interested in being the admin for your city, visit charitymakeover.org/podcast to learn more. And now back to the interview.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, like the problem that I'm seeing with many startups is that, like, in order, like, once you have a nice idea, then you need like to hire developers, you need to hire marketing teams, you need to hire salespeople, and then your product, you cannot sell your product in affordable prices anymore because it doesn't worth it. So like you must charge like 10 times more than what you would do if it was very lean product, a micro product. And then I think that, and then you add like thousands of features and you're becoming like these big vendors. So I think that the trick is to be focused on the one thing that you are trying to solve. And the one problem that is the most painful problem for the companies that you are trying to sell to. And I think that, like, for example, if you go back to the attribution part, the difficult part here is that most cases it's like these solutions are like one size fits all. You build some attribution model and then you put it in the platform and then all your customers need to follow the model that you've designed. But in most cases, it's not like this. Every company has a different way that they're looking at attribution. I think that this is what's so genius in Touchpoints, because I'm just giving you the data. Just do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
And I'm not spending a lot of money and time on developing these graphs and dashboards. And I want to mention one idea that I really believe in. So today there are like gazillions of solutions in the marketing space. And like, it's very difficult to be different from other solutions. And I'm hearing about like so many new and very innovative solutions for marketeers. And I think that today the problem is that most of the solutions are in between two parts of this industry. So one part is a very measurable solution. And these are solutions that will always be successful. For example, Google AdWords. So in Google AdWords or Facebook ads, you know how much money you put every month and you know how much money you make out of it. And it's precise, like you can precisely measure the success of these solutions. And these solutions, like as I see them, will live forever. Okay, it's very easy to use them, to justify them internally. The other side of this map is solutions that are kind of utility tools. So for example, no one pays, or most of the people are not paying for Google Analytics. But if you will wake up a marketeer and tell them, you don't have Google Analytics anymore, or just pay $1,000, so it will pay $1,000. But you must have Google Analytics, you must have it. Once you installed it, you can never take it out. I know marketeers that will rather like prefer to cut their leg or something and not get rid of Google Analytics. And it's the same like Gmail or WhatsApp. I don't know. These are, or Salesforce. Like companies, yeah. If they lose Salesforce one day, the company can disappear.
Yeah.
And I think so. This is the other side of the map. So measurable and utilities. And I think that all the companies, all the solutions that are in between, that are not very clear like where they are at, I think this will be very challenging for them to succeed over time. Because first of all, there are too many companies in this gap. And second of all, it's very, very difficult to justify it internally and to be able to pay for it. In the measurable part, the measurable side of the map, I think the big players like have most of the market, Google, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram. And then the utility tools, this is where you want to be. Like build like small, smart, automated solutions and find good niche over there. So if you find good niche in this side, you can build something, and something that is very easy to explain and to see the added value. Like, the added value is like to be able to help your end user to do his daily work better. Right. That's it. Google Analytics, I must have it because it helps me do my work, like show reports and graphs. So this is the trick, and find niche over there.
So, yeah, okay. So, I mean, so your process, it sounds like you basically have some conversations, you get some signal there from people that you talk to, you recognize what you think could be a problem, you ask them, like, how much would you actually pay for this? And then very soon thereafter, create a quick prototype in 48 hours, time box it, and then actually go and try to immediately sell it to those folks who said, yeah, I'd pay you $1,000 a month for this.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Love it. So you weren't you're not trained in computer science. You just picked up JavaScript and MySQL and Java and all these languages on your own, or how?
Yeah. So I'm developing, doing tech for the past 20 years. Since I was 14 years old, and I did work for when I worked at Aptrinsic, I was part of the engineering team, and also in Marketo, I worked a lot on the tech part. I don't have any like official, I didn't graduate computer science or something, but I'm doing it a lot, and most of my very technological work is done by technical teams around the world that I hire. And I do have six advisors, great advisors. Half of them are on the growth side and the half on the product and tech side. So they're like doing hands-on work, and they're helping me with development of the product.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think the average person, it's a very unique background that you have to be able to both been exposed to all the business challenges, but also have the programming experience and the ability to implement on your own. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you are, development and then sales and then support, and you basically run the full gamut. So you kind of see the whole spectrum. You're able to stay lean and mean just yourself, which is a really powerful thing. Mm-hmm. The average person, can anyone learn to code?
So I have two parts. So first thing, you don't need to code if you're not if you don't want to. I have, for example, a good friend of mine, and he's a partner of mine as well, that has a lot of great ideas of solutions that can be built. And whenever he has an idea, he hires a team over Fiverr or Upwork to develop it for him. So his most popular product was, 10 years ago. So we talked about UTM parameters and UTM tagging. So he told to himself, why do I need to do it manually every time? And then he just got a team in Ukraine to develop a Chrome extension that automatically shows you some UI that just you put in the UTM source, UTM medium, etc., and then it generates the link that you can use in your posts. So a few days after they went live with it, he tweeted, "Hey Google, did you saw my new UTM tagging tool?" And surprisingly, Google retweeted them. And in a matter of hours, he got tens of thousands of downloads for this Chrome extension. So this is a great example, because the guy doesn't have any technical skills, but he managed to do nice money out of it.
Yeah.
So this is one part. So the other side, although I'm technical and I always think about how you can automate the stuff with code, I think that it doesn't matter if you have the technical skills or not. The thing is that you need to combine two spaces, two worlds into a niche, and you need to find a pain that you can solve in an easy way. I never recommend to go and do like services, because services in most cases cannot, like, you, it's very hard to scale them up. But like, for example, I'll give you actually this was an example that I did recommend to do a services company. So I knew a girl in Israel that is working for a cannabis consulting firm, or it's a consulting firm that is specializing in cannabis. So I asked her, how many companies in Israel are there? And Israel is like a leader in cannabis, a world leader in cannabis, in medical cannabis production. So she told me, yeah, today there are not many. So I told her, so why aren't you like doing it freelance, as a freelancer? Because like the big companies will pay to this big firm, but the smaller companies are unable to pay a lot of money to get this kind of consulting. So she told me, yeah, this is actually makes a lot of sense. So again, this is not with technology, but I think like getting this niche and just do this due diligence and see if, like, I told her, okay, now go and check how many small cannabis companies are there in Israel and what they do today. So these days she's starting this kind of a business in Israel.
Yeah. So I think what's interesting is, like, so it's funny, ironically, I had a similar challenge in terms of attribution with UTM parameters. Mm-hmm. And by the way, UTM, for the people listening, is, I think it's urchin something, but it's basically,
yeah, it's urchin.
It's basically
urchin,
a way to
tracking,
tag module or something module. Like that. Yeah. It's the way that Google knows where someone came from. So if you can control the links that are coming into your site, you can specify these things like source and campaign and medium and mm-hmm. whatnot. And then that allows you then to know what's working and be able to attribute and say, okay, like, I'm spending money on social media or radio spots or whatever it is. And you can start to identify what's paying off. So anyways, I had a similar challenge myself using Gravity Forms, which is a WordPress plugin. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I just want to be able to cookie people when they hit the site and know that whenever they fill out a form, it's going to grab their UTM parameters and submit that and store it with the lead. And nothing like this existed. So same thing, like, I used to be a developer. I couldn't write a line of code today to save my life, but I hired someone on Upwork, you know, $50, guy out of Egypt, built this plugin, and I just open sourced it, put it up there. And mm-hmm. I still to this day get the little Camtasia, your video has been viewed too many times, it's going to shut down now, because it's the little tutorial that I made on that thing that shows how it works. Mm-hmm. So I know that it's getting a lot of usage and traffic and whatnot on GitHub, because it solves a problem that everyone else had. So I think Upwork, and, you know, for in the interest of helping people who are listening who, like, aren't technical and are trying to think, well, I've got this idea, how do I solve it? So hiring people on Upwork is certainly one way to outsource it, like you said. I would say no code is blowing me away right now. I don't know if you've played with it.
Yeah.
Like, what's your experience with no code?
Just a little bit, but I think that the idea, the approach of, like, not just before like hiring, like outsourcing your ideas. Again, just do a quick due diligence. I'm calling, I woke up with a great idea. I'm just calling someone in this market and asking him about, like, how much you will pay. Not just about if it's a cool idea or not. Are you willing to pay for it? And I'm usually starting my conversation, I must tell you about the new product that I've developed. Because, like, I want to make it more serious. Like, so do you need something like that? You want to see a demo? And then if I book a demo, like, okay, so sometimes, as I said, it's like very simple to develop. It's like, it takes a few days. I can already come up with a few slides and talk about the solution before I'm spending the money and the time and the efforts of developing the solution, just running a POC, like a dry POC without, before spending the time. Regarding no code, yeah, again, it just, a great way to get to stand in this 48 hours rule that I have of, like, getting to a first POC, working POC, in 48 hours before like diving into this development.
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate POC, you know, lean wise is mock up some screens. You can even use a tool like Envision, link them together, make a little clickable app that people can then use and try to sell that before you even have it. I mean, that's the leanest possible way to do this. I'm just blown away. Like in the last week, in 7 days, using a no-code tool, I did some research in the space and tinkered a bit. And then Tony, who is a mutual friend at the workspace, turned me onto this thing called Adalo. In the last 7 days, I've built the backend platform that I imagined for this charity makeover project that we're doing. And it's entirely custom. It's entirely what we need. It enables anyone to bring this whole event, you know, charity sponsorship, volunteer recruitment thing, and do it in their city. This thing, I just literally, without a line of code, built it in 7 days in my spare time while still working for Pagely. Like, it is mind blowing what these no code tools can do. And I just, like, to me, it's the use of a developer is not best spent writing CRUD operations. The developer should be there to solve those really, you know, interesting edge case challenges that are hard and that are like the true meat of the app. But like just the UI and the nonsense scaffolding that you have to deal with at this point, I think is completely solvable through no code.
And I want to extend to that. So POC is not something that you only need to do at the beginning of a product that you're working on. So if I, like when I started Watsly, so the POC took me 48 hours. It was a very, very, very lean product. It has only like, I think 1% of what it has today. And I was able to sell it as is, like 4 days after I launched it for the first customer. But then the first customer that I had was amazing. It was an Israel-based company, small one, but very, very advanced and sophisticated. And they are using a lot of solutions, and they are very proactive. Like we used to have a call almost on a daily basis, and they came up to me every time with great ideas, telling me like, "Look, I have one agent does that. Any chance you can add it somehow to the product?" And I said, yes, okay, this is a great, like this does the POC for me. They are willing to pay for something for this specific feature. So today, like 95% of the product is based on customer inputs. And so today the queue is very, very long already. But for sure, I think like continuous POC.
Yeah.
Like keep doing these small POCs along the way. And this is how, like at the beginning, I just thought Watsly would be just like a small product that I can sell, I don't know, for $1 or $2 per user, per seat. But then I realized that this can be a very, very robust product with many features, but very, specific ones that are based on customer inputs, exactly what the customer wants.
How do you go about pricing a higher dollar service like this? How do you quantify how big the problem is to the customer that they're willing to pay you $1,000 a month instead of $1 or $2 a month?
Because I said like most of my products are lean, so I usually like trying to, I see what the competitors are taking or other solutions in the market. And then like, I'm trying to price it like 50% and less to like be able to grow fast. There are no real rules about that. And I think like 3 years ago when I started my first business, Overstack.io, so I talked to a good friend of mine, Guy, and he was doing like, he had an agency already for 10 years. And I asked him, how do you price your services? How do you decide how much to charge from each company? So he told me like, you just need to try. I mean, he told me about one time that he asked for $200,000 for a project. And he never heard back from the customer. So he told me, hey, sometimes they will just say, okay, and that's great. Sometimes you will lose the customer. So I really believe in starting with a range, saying like where you are planning to get to. And then this is something that I've learned while I was doing sales, like face-to-face sales, like long time ago. And I learned that it doesn't matter the product, it's what matters is how you wrap it. And if you make it looks like it's worth a lot of money, and or not a lot, but it's worth the money that you ask for, so companies will pay for it. I never charge very, very low prices because I don't want like everyone to use it, because then it will make me a lot of noise, background noise. But so I still like keep it in the good range of prices.
And are you, so you're able to support all this as a one man show? You're able to still make it all work and be doing development on a new product and supporting old products and like making all that work as one person?
So I do have a small team of people that provide more support, like a backup. Because my products are zero touch, I'm always thinking about zero touch and or no touch solutions. So yes, but I have a background backup team, and as said, I don't have UI for most of my platforms. So if a problem occurs or something, so it needs to just be fixed in the background. The customer is it's seamless for the customer.
Yeah.
If there is a problem, like a sync doesn't work properly, or I want to add something to the sync, like the customer doesn't know about it. And it's great because these are marketing people. They don't want to touch technology. They have too many products and solutions that they're trying to operate at the same time. Of course, if there is a problem or something, so I let them know. But most cases, the product is just running. If they need some small tweaks, that are just being done in the background.
Cool, cool. All right. Well, we've been talking a lot about the guts of entrepreneurship and whatnot. I'm going to change gears here. You are from Tel Aviv, Israel?
Yes.
Born and raised or what?
No, I was born in Mexico City.
Okay.
and after 6 months, we moved back to Israel. I'm Israeli. Like, my parents just been there for a few years. Now for the past 7 years, I'm living in Tel Aviv. Recently, I just left the center of the city. I needed some more quiet. Tel Aviv is a bit noisy city, so I needed to
I've
take
never been. It's very
you
high on my
list. You should
come
and visit us.
I'm very interested to visit Israel.
It's a great entrepreneurship scene over there.
So. Well, that's what I was going to ask you is, like, I have heard that the scene, the entrepreneurial scene in Tel Aviv is actually incredible. And you guys have like a very strong investment community around it, and it's just very supportive. Yeah. Can you speak about that at all?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, similar to Tau Hub over here, I'm working in a place called Ono Hub. It's a small co-working space over there, close to where I live. And we have great community over there, great facilities. Besides that, I think like there are a few dozens of co-working spaces, and Tel Aviv is a relatively small city. So it's very easy to find like a great place to work at. Besides that, there are like accelerators. There are, I think, 15 places like WeWork and similar companies that opened co-working spaces, which are a bit more expensive, but they're worth it because of the networking, especially if you are digital nomad or you're working by yourself. So it's great. I used to work in one of the WeWork spaces over there in Tel Aviv. Besides that, I think that one of the most powerful things that we have in Israel, it's a meetup scene. And there are always great meetups around, in any topic that you can think of. So I specifically have a meetup for marketing people, for marketing like more senior marketing managers. It's called the CMO Confessions Tel Aviv. Like every few months, we are running like events in one of the local bars. We have great marketing people coming there. We have, 2,000 members in the group.
Nice.
Yeah. And besides that, most of the companies, like the largest companies and the more like the sexy companies, the Israeli companies, are based in Tel Aviv. So,
Waze. Who are the other unicorns?
Yeah, Waze actually. Yeah, Waze. I don't know where they are based now. We have Wix, we have Waze, we have Mobileye, and then we have Taboola, which now joined with Outbrain. And yeah, we have great companies over there, and they are sponsoring a lot of meetups, so you can go ahead and like to one of these companies and for to hear to attend the meetup. Google also has their HQ, like an office over there in the center of the city, and they have the Google the Google for Startups campus, and I'm working there every now and then, and that's it. Like any person that you meet in Israel, like we always like we start a conversation by saying, "Brother, how are you?" Like
we're
like yeah. Makore, Mainyanim. So it feels like a small and very united community. So it's very fun. And then you start, like, the next question is where you work at, like, what you do. And then, okay, you know this guy. And I almost work there. So you must know this person. So it's very, very fun. And I also, there are, slowly starting to be more and more smaller communities in Tel Aviv. So, for example, in the south, there is a neighborhood called Shchunat Shapira, Shapira neighborhood. So they have like, it's almost co-living. You have like apartments that you can rent from them, and then you get a co-working space, and you have a gym, and they are doing parties, and they even have restaurants and bars. So if you are a community member, so you get everything almost for free. So this is very cool.
So it seems like one of the other, yeah, those are all amazing components, and I will definitely take you up on that offer. I, like I said, it's very high on my list.
You will get a beer on me, and I'll take you to the best hummus place over there.
I am a hummus connoisseur, yeah. So I will absolutely take you up on that. The other component that seems to me, from what I understand, is like typically when there's an exit, like the Waze folks, when they then become investors, you have this diaspora of, you know, folks who came into money, who understand how to build a company, and who are now then, you know, turning that back and incubating new founders, and you kind of have, you get this nice like cyclical effect going on. Does it have much of that there? Like, are the people who came out of exits now then starting to reinvest?
Yes, I think besides the financial part of it, I think that's getting like hearing the stories behind it. From, you know, first source, like I think 2 years ago I attended the meetup where Waze, the one of the co-founders at Waze, was talking and telling the story about how they started, and it was fascinating. It told, like, it was telling about the fact that when they started, they didn't have even one person over there that understands, that knows how to operate maps. Because there are no maps in Waze. Like, the maps are being generated automatically, dynamically by the users. And this is a very surprise. And one story that I like to tell that I've heard from him. So the challenge that they had there is to know the number of the building. If you think about it, so the maps are being generated automatically, but then if you're trying to navigate to, I don't know, Dizengoff Street and number 55. So how would Waze know to direct you to the right building? So then he said that they figured that there are like rules in every country. So in Israel, for example, one side is like double.
Odd or even? Or?
Yeah, odd or even. So in Israel, for example, one side of the street is odd and the other side is even. So you would say that if the street starts at 1 and then ends at 100, so it will be on the right side of the street, somewhere in the middle of the street. And in the US, it's easier because it's blocks, right? You have 100 to 200 and then 200 to 300, etc. And then in China, it was impossible for them because in China, the first building in the street is the oldest one. So it's a nightmare. Yeah. Like, so they just passed on that in China. You cannot navigate to a specific building. I don't know if they changed it, but this is how it used to be. So again, I think this is much more powerful, and it inspires you because you hear these small stories, and then when you do it by yourself and you're going through these processes, you use all these experience that you acquired from listening to other entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and arguably that's more valuable than the cash that they have to invest, is just that experience. And you know, I'm sure, how do you even quantify having been through it? And
yeah, you know. I mean, of course, like getting a few millions for your startup, it's a Kickstarter. It's great start. I never raised like millions for my companies, and I think today I actually read an article recently about it. Today, more and more companies are trying to avoid raising money, trying to run bootstrap with their company, because this is I think more sustainable way of building a company. If you are chasing after like fundraising, it just takes you off the focus of building a great and sustainable company. If you are running after making your customers happy, gaining more and more customers, building great product that actually solves painful problems, I think this is a great model of like building a company, and this is what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. 100%. I did a company where we raised $750,000, friends and family and angel, and then proceeded to go and do the Silicon Valley roadshow, met with 14 venture capitalists.
Yeah, this is amazing.
You're right, though. It takes your eye off the ball of keeping your customers happy. And if that doesn't work, then it doesn't matter what money you're raising. Like, if you screw that up, then, and you succeed in raising money, then it's just basically kind of inevitable that it will fail eventually. So,
and in the article that I've read, they mentioned like Uber and WeWork. So these companies raised like tons of money, and then their model wasn't holding like water. It was just like, it's great, Uber and WeWork, of course, they solve like very painful problems, but then building these companies a bit slower and focusing more on the added value to the customers, I think this is what counts.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we are just over the hour mark, so I'll start winding down here. I do want to ask you one more question, just because I happen to be wearing the shirt today, but I didn't realize that. Krav Maga, that's a Israeli self-defense system. Mm-hmm. Do they...
I didn't even notice.
I didn't realize I was wearing it until then when we were having the conversation. But so this is something... Do you guys learn that? Like, I understand like Israeli has mandatory military service. Everyone does the 2 years mm-hmm. in it. Is that something like the whole society learns there, or what's the role of Krav Maga?
We are learning it in the military, in the army, the military service. Everyone knows it. We're not very using it in day to day. We're very polite people.
But maybe that's why it's so peaceful. Like I took it for 6 months, and the gym where I trained in Arizona had a saying on the wall that was just like, so others may walk in peace. And it's like, when you have that skill, then it's kind of like it is a lot more peaceful. And I'm just curious if you find that to be true there.
Yeah, it's not very useful in Israel. But I can tell you that, again, every skill that you are having is a great thing. I can tell you that when I had my first degree in the south, it was like my apartment was 4 kilometers from Gaza Strip. So over there you are a bit more stressed, especially in like times where it's a bit more dangerous. But yeah, it's very quiet in Tel Aviv. People are living very peacefully.
how, so I know Trump just revealed some grand Middle Eastern strategy plan recently. I haven't read it. I don't know personally even what it involves, but like, what's your thoughts on how does the Gaza Strip situation, Palestine, all that, how does that resolve? I know that's a big question to throw at you.
I'll tell you my non-political answer to that. Yeah. Basically, I think politics is very scrambled these days in Israel. Like, all parties are like saying almost the same thing, so it's very hard to know which way you want to go. I can tell you that at the end of the day, like, besides the Tel Aviv people, which just work hard, like trying to enjoy their life as much as possible. It's very pricey to live in Tel Aviv. So like we work more and more and more, and we're trying to innovate a lot, and we're trying to do great things and to improve our life and our friends and our family's life all the time. And I think that eventually at the end of the day, we just want the simple things of living together in peace, living quietly, enjoying life. And, you know, we want, doesn't matter even the right-hand parties and the left-hand parties and the center. We all want peace and be quiet. Like, like status quo that will that everyone will be happy with. So, I know this is a bit vague, but I think this is the main thing. We don't want to fight anyone. We don't want to make harm to anyone, and hopefully we'll get to it.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully the other people feel the same way.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's dig into, we got one last part here where we talk through basically like a rapid fire kind of question round. It's called the breakdown. So are you ready for the breakdown?
Yes. Breakdown, baby.
All right, what is one book that has profoundly affected you?
My favorite book is The Alchemist.
Ditto. That's my favorite book.
Yeah, I've read it like 5 times. Including one of them in English and one of them in Spanish. I tried in Spanish. It was difficult, but I knew the story. So Alchemist, I'm sorry. I took yours.
Paulo Coelho, very near and dear to my heart. What is one person you'd love to have dinner with? Could be living or dead, doesn't matter.
Elon Musk, yeah.
Yep, cool.
Elon Musk. I think that the way that he thinks, like even, for example, the example where they throw rocks on his new Jeep. Did you see it? On the new Tesla?
No, I didn't see that.
So he said that the windows would never break. There is nothing that can break the windows of this Jeep. So they throw blocks or something on his rocks on the windows and they broke up. Yeah. So he... like went on a PR, like on a press release, and just said, he was wearing a T-shirt with the broken window, so he just took it and like turned it into something positive. Like, here we're laughing about ourselves. This was the original plan, but the way of like how you take something bad and turns it into something great. I love this approach, and I think like I'm tracking everything, almost everything he does, and I kind of admire him. I know it's like,
have you read his book?
No.
Amazing. Yeah, just to have the goals that guy does when he operates. He's not thinking about, oh, I'm gonna build this company and make money. He's thinking like, how do I improve the survivability of the human species by making us interplanetary and not dependent on coal. And like, he's just thinking at such an incredible level that
This is the way he thinks, like not what he builds, not like how he's succeeding or failing with companies, the way he thinks. I think also if I'm allowed, Mark Benioff, Salesforce CEO, Also, I think I recently read a few articles about like interviews that he gave. The way he thinks, the way he sees the ecosystem and other companies, how he sees Facebook, for example. I find it very aligned with the way, like, I think we are, I see some of the things in the same eye as him. And I've read the book about Jeff Bezos recently, about Amazon, how they started. So very inspiring.
I haven't read that one
the
yet.
Small, how it's called? Small Smart Shop or something like that.
Small Smart Shop. Okay, we'll link that one in the show notes. What is one tool or hack that saves you time, money, or headaches?
I guess everyone will say Integromat or Zapier. Let me think about something else. I'll take you to the technical side, JavaScript. Just learn JavaScript. I mean, it's sometimes easier for me and quicker for me to just write 3 lines of codes to make like something to extract data from somewhere, or JavaScript. Code Academy, a week and a half, you learn JavaScript, you do amazing stuff with it.
Nice. Yeah, it's definitely a superpower. I wish that I had started with that. I learned Cold Fusion, so I was a developer of 8 years with this kind of arcane programming language, and I was enough good at JavaScript to modify it, but I never could like write it from scratch. But that's one of those things where I feel like everything now with Node and all these tools that are just basically JavaScript is at the root of everything. It's almost like the Latin of programming languages now for the web. So, cool. What about, what is one piece of music or musical artist that speaks to you lately?
So I have a surprising answer for this one. So when I was 6 years old, my parents took me to the local music school, and the manager there asked me what do I want to play on. So me as a 6 years old boy, I told them I want violin. So until today, my parents deny that, but I think that they just behind my back, told them no way this guy is gonna play violin at our house. So the manager told me, you know, violin, it's a bit difficult to start with. Maybe you should start with piano and then go to violin. So I said okay, and until today I'm playing piano. And then 6 months ago, I decided to, one day I just woke up and I just went and bought a violin and I started playing. It's an amazing instrument. I really love it. So I recently listened to more and more like violin music. So I don't have anything specific. Tchaikovsky, maybe.
Cool.
But yeah.
All right. We'll link to some Tchaikovsky in the show notes. What is one important truth that very few people agree with you on?
So I have it's kind of a mantra that makes me do most of the stuff, like the unexpected stuff that I am doing, is that I always say that these are the best years of my life. I'm saying it for the past like 10 years. So whenever, like, I don't know, I need to go to the gym and I don't want to, so I just think, okay, these are the best years of my life. If now I won't do it, so when will I? And then if I'm trying to convince my friends to do something, so it became a joke already. These are the best years of your life. Come on, you must come with me to this party, or you must go with me to do something, to go to the restaurant or something. So the best years of your life. Doesn't matter how old are you, just say to yourself every day, and then just get up and do whatever you want to do. Now
you're not getting tomorrow. Any younger, so
you don't, like, the mantra of like it might be the last day of our life, blah blah. I mean, okay, but now it happens, like, these are the best years of your life.
Cool.
So
I love, there's a quote from Steve Jobs in his Stanford commencement address where he's talking about like how he evaluates his lens for viewing, like if he needs to change something. He says, like, every day I wake up, I look in the mirror, and if I ask myself the question, if this was the last day I was living, would I want to be doing what I'm going to do today? And if he answers no too many days in a row, then he changes something. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very similar kind of lens to view things through.
Yeah, there is another technique that I used to use when I was doing face-to-face sales. Like the end of the day, when I put my head on the pillow, like asking myself if I've done the 100%, if I took it, like I used 100% of the time today, and if not, so just get up, do something, and then go back to sleep. I was happy that it didn't happen so many times. So,
cool. All right. Last question here. If you had a time machine to go back to your former 20-year-old self, mm-hmm. what piece of advice would you give yourself?
So this is something that I've learned a bit after the military service, in the hard way, to always be like, when you make hard decisions or you make very important decisions, you should always make the choice that you are that you feel that is the right one at the moment, and given the circumstances, given everything that you know at the moment, because later, like a few years later, when you're looking back, it's very easy that way to say I was right, because the situation that I was at this specific moment, this was the right choice. And the second part of it is to always make the decision like in the shortest time that you can. Like if you just start to think about it and think about it, and so it just, sometimes you will never do it. Like when you have an idea, when you have something you want to do, when you have something you want to change, give it a deadline, like a few days, and then after this deadline, that's it. You make the decision. If it's good or bad, that's it. But you're taking everything you know at the moment into this consideration and make the decision.
Cool. So. Yeah, and you're like kind of living proof in terms of your approach with the two-day proof of concept, yeah, and really, yeah, just living, yeah, that. That's great.
If I may, one story about this part. So when I traveled in South America many years ago, like 10 years ago, I traveled by myself, and like it was very scary. It was the first time of me traveling in the world by myself. I didn't know the language. Like I started in Brazil, so I didn't know Portuguese, and I didn't know where I'm going to. It was like dark, completely dark. And then I learned with the time over there that nothing, there is like the chances that something bad will happen are super, super, super small, very super, super, super low. And then the mantra that I had during this trip was that even if something bad will happen, like I don't know, I get robbed or something, this will be the day that I remember in the trip. And sometimes like these bad things change the way your life are going. Like this leaves something that changes you. And this, I slowly started to be thrilled by this thought. Like, and I think that sometime, like one time I traveled with four guys from Israel that I met over there. And we were looking for hotels. It was like late night already. And most of the hotels were fully booked. And then they told, like, they started panicked. Like, what will we do? And I told them, look, eventually we will find somewhere to place. Eventually we will find some place to stay. But if not, this will be a story. This will be a night that we will remember as this night that we walked the whole night. And then eventually we just were sleeping on a, I don't know, in the street. And this is something that you remember for the rest of your life. When you tell someone about your South America trip, you will tell about this night that you were sleeping on the street. And this is something that I took, like when I started my business, I told myself, what is the worst case scenario? I'll lose all of my money when I'm 30 years old. Okay, bummer, but this is the bad that it can get. And I think this is what drives me in many decisions that I'm taking.
One of the previous guests to you, Julia Shem, two guests ago, talked about fear setting. And this is something that Tim Ferriss advocates, where it's basically you're imagining the worst possible case scenario. And that once you can be okay with, like, that's the worst, then it kind of immunizes you from all this irrational fear that is just kind of gunk.
Yeah.
When you just like go there. And it's, what's funny is also I have a similar story traveling 20 years ago in Ecuador, and a group of us was going to the beach. Total snafu. We ended up like riding in a dump truck, and like the road was washed out.
It.
We got there like because the bus couldn't pass a road that was washed out. We had to like get in this back of this dump truck, and we like didn't get to the beach in time. We got to this little town, and everything was closed. There was nothing. There was no hotels. There was nobody there. Everyone was asleep, and we're like, frick, where do we, like, we're gonna be homeless. We're literally gonna be sleeping on the streets. We ended up sleeping in like an ATM booth, six of us crowded in, right?
I love it.
But it's sure enough, that's what I
remember.
Yeah, that's what I remember the whole trip, you know?
That's it. It's amazing. This is how you acquire new experiences, how you're like having adventures while you're traveling, and in general, whatever you do.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think this is probably a good place to wrap it up. Yanir, if people listening want to get a hold of you, or they want to follow you or use your product, where do we send them?
So first of all, if you're Salesforce customers, I don't know how many of you are using Salesforce, but you're welcome to check out Watsly, watsly.com. If you are in marketing and you need some challenges, some help with some of your challenges, or you want someone to solve your painful your pain points, you can check out overstack.io, and you can follow me on Twitter, Yanir CLSR.
Awesome, cool. And the show notes for this episode, I have a feeling, are going to be extremely long. We talked about a lot of different acronyms and products and whatnot, so all of that stuff will be, for the people listening, it will be on the episode, so you can go back and find all the links to this stuff. And Yanir, it's been such a pleasure, man.
Thanks, Sean.
We got to do this.
It's great.
Cheers. If you have a substantial social media following and consider yourself a micro-influencer in the digital nomad space, I invite you to check out a program I'm in the early stages of rolling out. I call it the Advocate Program for Nomad Podcast and Nomad Prep. It's a multi-level affiliate program that enables you to monetize the social media following you've built by referring my course to your followers. You can earn commission on both students you originate directly as well as students who come in via the advocates you originate, essentially a downline, and all through simply introducing your following of aspiring nomads to a course that can help them more confidently make the leap. I'm in the process of selecting a small group of early advocates who I'll be working with closely to refine this program and make it effective. In exchange for early participation, those influencers will be grandfathered in at the highest level of commission that will ever be offered in this program. To learn more about the program and the referral numbers necessary to generate a four-figure monthly side income, visit nomadprep.com/advocates and apply today. That URL again is nomadprep.com/advocates. Help aspiring nomads make the leap and get paid for doing so.